Well, next up, as we slowly approach Halloween, let's talk about some bizarre phenomena. Let's talk about monsters. Let's talk about all of that when we come back in a moment with Seth Breedlove on Coast to Coast AM. Here we go with Seth Breedlove, film director, producer, writer. He's been a radio host. He's contributed content to numerous websites on all kinds of topics. In 2013, he began researching the Minerva Monster case, and after compiling a library of information related to that case, he decided to make a film based on that situation. He has since directed several films, Minerva Monster, The Beast of Whitehall, and a third, of course, Boggy Creek. That's right. That was one of yours, Seth, wasn't it?
Yeah, Boggy Creek was our third movie, and since then we've done Mothman and Invasion. So we like to stay as busy as possible.
Well, good for you. How have you been?
Good. How about you?
Good. Everything's fine. Keeping busy, and can't believe how fast this year has just zoomed by.
Yeah, we've stayed busy with filming and chasing monsters around the United States like sane people do.
Are we still getting lots of reports on strange creatures all over the place?
Oh yeah, yeah. And this year seems like it's an exceptionally busy year, especially for these sort of rural monster stories taking place near rural communities. We get emails and phone calls on a fairly regular basis with people wanting us to make, you know, movies about their local monster. So it seems like right now is a very, very busy time for hairy creatures that are lurking in the woods.
Initially, too, when they call you and say there's a monster out here, what do you think? Do you think, oh, I'm not sure, or what happens?
Well, I mean, typically we don't. That isn't the approach we take to making the movies. But I think, you know, if someone approaches me with a story, I'm always intrigued just for my own interest in cryptozoology and cryptids in general. So I tend to look into it. What I love, though, is when there's a cryptid story about some sort of, you know, quote-unquote monster that involves, like, a history in the area that goes back, you know, preferably decades. And when I get those reports where they do have that sort of history, that's when I get kind of excited and want to look into it a little bit more, because you obviously hear tons of sighting reports of people encountering creatures in the woods, but it's not every case that has a, you know, a past, a monster
that's, right,
that's been there for decades.
Let's talk about some things you've worked on, and we'll take calls next hour with people who just love these subjects. Chestnut Ridge, tell us about that.
Chestnut Ridge is Invasion on Chestnut Ridge is a pretty big departure for us, actually. It's a look at the Chestnut Ridge in southwestern Pennsylvania, which is a 72-mile stretch of mountain range where strange activity has been occurring since the late 1800s. It started kind of with your typical, you know, wild man ape reports, and then it started to become a little different in 1965 when there was a reported crash of a strange object near the town of Kecksburg, Pennsylvania. And obviously that's become an extremely famous case in ufology, and it's frequently referred to as the East Coast Roswell. But in our film, we cover that story as being sort of a catalyst for decades of strange activity that followed it. And the film delves into that story, but then it goes into kind of all sorts of UFO and creature-related subjects and other phenomena as well, like orbs and strange things in the woods. But it's the first time we've covered such an expansive section of one state and sort of the long history of bizarre activity, from UFO reports to Bigfoot and Dogman and strange lights in the woods. And, you know, obviously there's also supposedly ghostly activity in that area. So whatever is going on along the Chestnut Ridge, it seems to be widespread and extremely varied in how the phenomena presents itself. So our film kind of delves into all these different aspects of different phenomena that take place along the ridge.
And how far back do these stories go?
Yeah, like I said, I think it's the late 1800s are some of the oldest reports we have. And I know in looking into newspaper archival research for myself, what I saw were, you know, your typical sort of wild man reports from the late 1800s, but then there were also a lot of reports of, like, phantom black cats and encounters with the supernatural, with typically, like, more, like, ghostly type things. And this goes back to probably, like, 1880 is when I found one of the older wild man reports. We were told while we were on the ridge filming that there were encounters with strange lights in the sky, which would be, you know, like classic sort of UFO reports that went back to the 1800s, but that's more told through oral tradition rather than, you know, newspaper reports or anything like that. Reported activity goes back to the 1800s.
How big is the ridge, Seth?
It's 72 miles long, and it starts just above Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and it winds.
That's pretty long. That's a long.
Yeah, it winds its way actually into West Virginia too. So it's kind of covers both states.
What do some of the townspeople say about this? I mean, are they concerned about these sightings of all these things?
I think more than anything, what we discovered while we were there is that a lot of people just consider this to be part of their history. So it's almost as if, since this has been going on as long as it has, a lot of the locals just view it as another part of the local scenery. So if someone has a sighting report of a UFO or a creature in the woods and talks about it, and it somehow makes the newspaper, more than anything, locals look at it as if, well, that's not really a surprise being in this area. I know when the film came out, the local tourism board watched the movie and actually did a review on it, and they talked about it with us as if this was no great surprise to them. This sort of thing happens there. People are aware of it. Whether or not they believe in the creatures that people say they're seeing is sort of irrelevant. It's more about the fact that this is something that they're well aware gets reported on a frequent basis.
Our dear friend Jim Harold does a podcast. I believe you were on one of them talking about Chestnut Ridge, weren't you?
Yeah. Jim and I, too, we've traveled together a little bit. So anytime I do a film, he tends to have me on and we get to talk a little bit. And obviously the Chestnut Ridge is so well known because of the work of Stan Gordon, who
yes,
many people, you know, look to as sort of the expert on the Chestnut Ridge. And he's in our film. But yeah, Jim and I always enjoy talking about this stuff, and it inevitably gets off track, and we end up talking about, like, independent film and independent podcasting and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, he's a good guy, and he loves the field, doesn't he?
Yeah, I think to be into this as long as Jim has been, you sort of have to, right? Because, I mean, you know that, but,
yep,
like, you almost have to have a passion for the subject beyond just, you know, some sort of temporary knowledge base that you've acquired.
Have there been any reports, Seth, out there at the Chestnut Ridge of these creatures trying to harm somebody? Do you get any of that?
So when it comes to your sort of like Bigfoot reports and those type of creature reports, they're typically just like most reports that you take. People see them cross the road or, you know, walking through the forest. There is a really fascinating Dogman account. And there were actually a few Dogman accounts we took while we were there, but the one in our film that we talked about revolves around these three women who pulled up at a park called Roaring Run Park, and they got out of their car, and as they were approaching the trailhead, they see this figure walking out of the dark toward them, and it's sort of, if I remember right, it's sort of late in the afternoon, and there was a light mist, so it almost sounds like you're watching a Hammer horror film or something like that. But this figure approaches them out of the dark on two legs, and as it comes closer, they notice that it's got a large snout and two pointed ears. And it's then that they realize this is, you know, some sort of canine, upright walking canine creature. And the thing opened its mouth and snarled at them as it came forward. One of the ladies, two of the other women turned around and bolted back to the car. One of the ladies stood there and locked eyes with the thing, and they actually stared at each other for a while. And she didn't exactly express any feeling that this thing was going to attack her, but whatever happened, they had a stare down that lasted for a while before the thing turned around and just sort of sauntered off looking at her. So that was, you know, like when you hear these reports, there's that one, and then there's also the account of the one of the accounts of Thunderbird sightings in the area. Of course, Thunderbirds are sort of feathered, or in some cases more like a prehistoric pterodactyl-looking creature. But there was a man that was in a state park there, near Keystone State Park, who encountered this Thunderbird. And I guess what happened is he was in his truck, and this thing was in the middle of the field. He thought it was a deer at first, sort of hunkered down. And as he approached it in the truck, the thing stood up on its hind legs and unfurled these wings that he thought were, I think, in the neighborhood of 18 feet across.
Like a Cessna.
Yeah, huge, huge bird. And it flew actually at him. And his impression of the bird was that this thing was... if he had not been in the truck, this thing would have picked him to pieces, are the words he said. So there are definitely encounters with things other than creatures just seen walking, you know, through the undergrowth. I mean, some of this stuff does seem like these things could rip you apart if they wanted to.
Absolutely. Now, have some of the townsfolks gone out there with rifles to see what they could do?
Definitely. That's a frequent theme of small town monsters films that we're discovering, is that there's a lot of these armed posses that inevitably form and go out in the woods looking for the monster.
Right. So if there's anybody faking it, they're in deep trouble.
Oh yeah, and I always think that's one of the you know, detractions from it being, from these sort of cases being hoaxed a lot of the time. I do think there are hoaxes, but I think a lot of the time you'd be taking your life into your own hands, especially in a place like rural Pennsylvania where everyone's armed. You know, the odds of getting blown away while you're in your Bigfoot costume are pretty good in that area. But the interesting thing about those posse reports is some of them do go back. Some of those posse, those armed posse reports, go back to the 1800s.
Jeez.
So you're actually talking about sort of the forefather for your classic, like, Frankenstein monster, you know, armed with pitchforks, like an angry mob armed with pitchforks wandering into the woods to kill a monster.
I'm not sure that anybody would be charged with anything killing a creature if it turned out to be a human inside of a costume. I don't think you could get charged with that.
No, I imagine not. I don't know what the charge would be. And of course, a couple of years ago, there was a guy that was struck by a car. And I think I don't think he was in a costume. I think he was in a ghillie suit, but he was out trying to scare, traffic along a highway somewhere. And it actually got struck and killed by a car. And I'm not sure what the end result of that was, but that's an interesting case that I've heard of.
Let's talk about ghost stories that they hear out that way, Seth. What are some of those that come to mind?
The most frequent stories that we heard revolving around ghosts tended to be not creatures, but beings or sort of misty type apparitions that were seen often in or around old farmhouses. And something to keep in mind is that a lot of the farms in that area date back to the 1800s, and some even prior to that. In fact, we rented an 1800s farmhouse when we filmed Invasion on Chestnut Ridge. That's actually where we stayed, was in this old farmhouse, and it was even supposedly haunted by the ghost of the caretaker who had lived on those grounds for years. His name was Brad, which led us to kind of joke around that was the least interesting ghost name you could have. You're haunted by the ghost of Brad. But supposedly, there a lot of those farms, people encounter, you know, beings or apparitions of the former landowners. So in one case, there was a man that was out by this well who kept hearing this sort of ghostly cry, like from a lady,
mm-hmm.
Sort of a female cry. And he looked down into the well and said he actually saw the face of a woman looking up from the bottom of this well, this empty well, I guess. And that was actually at the house directly across from the house that we stayed at while we were there. So the ghostly activity in that area is actually more prevalent than some of the other phenomena that are reported, like UFOs and Bigfoots and things like that. And it seems like every older historical house has some sort of haunting tale. And all the landowners love regaling you with those stories, by the way, because they love freaking people out. And of course, when Stan Gordon got into this subject, that was one of the most frequent calls he was taking, especially in the late 60s when he was still a teenager, and into the 70s were reports of haunted houses. And him and his crew that would actually go out and investigate those cases. It always reminds me of like Scooby-Doo, because you can kind of picture Stan as a young guy with his posse of ghost hunters heading out every time a phone call comes in.
Do these stories, Seth, kind of help the area for tourism, or does it have any effect on that?
Prior to Stan getting involved, I don't think there was any interest in it by the locals as far as tourism is concerned. But when Stan got involved, what you had happen is that the town of Kecksburg, Pennsylvania, sort of embraced their UFO crash history. And since then, they have put on the UFO festival in Kecksburg every year, which is, according to Stan, it's attended by thousands. And I can tell you, we were there this year, and the parking lot was so full you couldn't even find a space to park.
Really? That's great.
And they put on this little parade where they actually bring an old Army flatbed trailer truck through town, and it's got a tarped
like a bell underneath it.
Yeah, like the bell on the back of the truck comes through town. So I think they're starting to see the benefit to local tourism that this kind of thing can bring. But as far as the rest of the ridge, I'm not aware of any other like major activity or anything like that.
Just amazing that it's that long, 70 miles plus long. And so the terrain is what, all woods?
It's extremely wooded, yeah. And you're talking 72 miles of much of it state park. There's parks like Ohio Pile is along the ridge, and the Keystone State Park and all that. So there's plenty of protected land along the ridge as well. Some private land, a lot of hunting, you know, spots where people go hunting, So I think more than anything else, it's that. But what you do have are these little pockets of civilization, these like tiny small towns that are all along the base of the ridge. There aren't many towns or even dwellings on the actual ridge itself.
Is everybody out in that area familiar with these stories?
Yeah, I think you'd be hard-pressed to find people who aren't, mostly because the local media kind of eats this stuff up, so it's reported very frequently, and they, you know, obviously, like most small-town newspapers, they're going to love the chance to kind of delve into creatures and UFOs and ghosts and things like that, especially around this time of year. So it's well reported on, but I think more than that, what you find is that locals are aware of this because of hearing stories from their parents and their great grandparents, and you know the history that kind of surrounds this stuff is well known, I think, from just from oral tradition.
These amazing stories that just keep cropping up, they just don't seem to stop, do they?
Right. No, it really, in fact, I think what we're seeing is an escalation over the years of reports, and especially in the type of reports that are coming in. This is something Stan told us, is that the reports just get stranger and stranger. And if you read his books on Pennsylvania, it's pretty obvious that the type of things people are seeing are getting to the point where it's completely unexplainable. There's a report in our movie that he told of an actual flying dragon. So someone,
let's talk about that when we come back, Seth. Plus, we'll get into some UFO stories as well. I'm George Norrie. Seth Breedlove, our special guest, his website, smalltownmonsters.com. And we will take your stories and questions next hour with Seth Breedlove, but now we're going to continue talking to him about the Chestnut Ridge story and some others. How prevalent are UFO stories in this area, Seth, compared to Bigfoot stories or ghost stories?
They really exploded in 66 and 67 and just kind of have become more and more popular, I think, or more and more widely reported. And obviously 65 is the Kecksburg UFO crash, so it probably acted as some sort of, the way Eric Altman put it in the movie, is a catalyst for people to come forward with their own experiences. So we had the 1965 UFO, you know, crash, but then we also have a report right away in 1966 by a kid who was 6 years old and saw this light in the sky that looked like basically like a, you know, like a Christmas tree ornament going overhead. And for some reason, that Christmas tree ornament description pops up a lot along the ridge, and it's the only place where I've heard that description of UFOs as looking like a Christmas tree ornament. And so I think they're probably more popular than any other type of report other than possibly ghostly type of activity. But there have definitely been kind of swells or waves in how they come and go. There's always reports, but there are times where there are considerably more UFO reports. I'm not sure right now what the predominant sort of phenomena along the ridge is, but I do know that Stan told me that he just had taken a UFO report in the last couple of weeks, so they're still coming in regularly.
What's the Uniontown Bigfoot UFO story?
So that's probably next to Kecksburg, the most famous sort of story along the ridge, and it revolves around this farmer who one night noticed this strange object in his field or above his field. It was about 100 feet in diameter, and it looked like a floating dome. And it was orange-ish sort of flaming, you know, object in the sky. He went and got a couple other locals and went up to investigate. He actually went up to the field where this thing was at to investigate it. And when he got up there, he saw the craft or whatever it was had landed in the field, and you could see the glow of this object over the crest of this hill. And as he was walking across the field to go investigate what it was, they see these two figures sort of following this fence line. And as they come closer, they realize they're two basically what he said looked like Bigfoot-type creatures. Approaching him, they have glowing green eyes, and they're covered in fur. And as they're coming toward them, he had a shotgun at the time that he had loaded with, for some reason, he'd loaded a tracer round. And I think he had a couple of regular bullets as well, but he fired a shot at these things as they came close to them, because they started to get a sense of the size of these creatures. Obviously, you know, you're talking Bigfoot, you're talking eight foot tall, you know, hair covered,
yeah,
glowing green-eyed creature. He fires a shot at this thing, and when he does, it reaches its hand out almost as if to stop the bullet. And as soon as it does, there's a flash of light, and the light that was in the field from the craft just goes out. So the basically what happened is it looked almost as if the UFO had just winked out of existence when this happened. The creatures continued coming toward him at that point, and he fired a couple more shots. And he is convinced, he was convinced, that at least one of the shots had hit one of the creatures, possibly more than once, without this thing even seeming to notice. So after that, these two creatures turn around and they walk back up the fence line. Now, one of the weirder aspects of this is as they were approaching, there was the report from the witness that he heard what sounded like baby crying, sort of a baby crying sound. And that is, again, like the Christmas tree ornament UFO. It's one of the weirder aspects of the phenomena along the ridge that is frequently reported is the strange baby crying.
Now, a cat sounds like a baby crying sometimes.
Sure, and so does, yeah, mountain lions sound that way. Also, like a fox in heat can sound like that as well. It's not that uncommon, but this sound is almost as if they're, you know, supernaturally mimicking this baby crying noise, and it's very frequently reported. But that what's really strange about that case is that it didn't end there. They they turned around and walked off. But after that, the witness ended up having sort of visions and having almost the nervous breakdown. And he went on to have serious issues with that case and the fallout from it in years to follow. So it's one of the most well-known sort of Bigfoot reports, and what it did was sort of start to put in people's minds that the Bigfoot phenomenon and the UFO phenomenon were intersecting. And this especially happened along the ridge in 1973 and 74, particularly in Westmoreland County, which is, and all those cases were investigated by Stan Gordon, obviously.
Do you get reports of people missing in those areas?
That's the most common question we're getting asked. I only know of one really sort of well-known missing persons case, and I'm not sure it's connected to any bizarre, you know, sort of unearthly occurrence. But if it was going to happen, that would be the perfect place for it. And it's something that could very well be happening. I just haven't probably looked into that as much as I should, because I would be curious if that sort of falls within the realm of like David Plaidy's missing 411.
Exactly. Yeah, he's going to be on our show in a couple weeks. And,
yeah. Ask him about the Chestnut Ridge.
Yeah, exactly. How about alien abduction cases?
Alien abduction cases, there definitely have been. And the one we spend the most time on is probably one of the scariest, sort of creepiest incidents I've ever been involved in when it comes to interviewing a witness. There was a witness who was also an investigator named Barry Clark, and we interviewed Barry. And Barry, back in the day when Stan was running the Westmoreland County UFO Study Group, Barry was one of the key investigators that was involved in it. And Barry was a very intelligent, well-read, smart, learned guy. And Barry had been called out to this one particular location known as the Bell Farm on multiple occasions for UFO reports, but also for Bigfoot reports. So they were seeing lots of strange activity on this farm. He was called out one particular evening because there was this reoccurring theme happening where at about 10 o'clock at night, each night, if you looked up in the sky in this one spot, you would see this light all of a sudden just turn on. This very bright silver light would just turn on. So he went out to the farm to investigate this one night because he wanted to see it for himself. He was out there with the landowner and his wife, and sure enough, right at the time they had said, this light flickers on in the sky. And as soon as it does, all these little silvery lights appear around it, like smaller versions of the bigger light. And they went to it, and he said it looked like they were going to, like bees to a beehive. They go to that light, and as soon as they go to that light turns blood red. And then they noticed that this light is actually getting closer to the ground. And they felt like it might have actually been coming down to land toward them. So they got absolutely terrified and headed home. Well, what happened is in the days and months and even years to follow, Barry started suffering lost time experiences wherein he would be driving from one town to another and 3 hours would pass.
Jeez. And he didn't even know how he got from one place to the next.
Right. 10 minutes should have passed, instead it'd be 3 hours would pass. And what got really unnerving for him and eventually drove him out of paranormal research entirely was the fact that he had a young grandson who was living with him at the time. And his grandson started telling him stories, or would wake up in the morning and tell him how he was being visited at night by these strange men who had come through a hole in his ceiling. And there were many unnerving things that happened to Barry, that kind of relate to UFO abductions, actual physical. Things that he would wake up in the morning and have these physical malfunctions, things that had obviously taken place to him during the night that he didn't know how it had got there. And what was so scary about it, or for me personally, was when we interviewed him, he actually had to shut the cameras off and told us stories relating to the fallout from his sort of UFO abduction. that we couldn't even put in the movie, unfortunately. But just personally interviewing him and hearing his version of this stuff was extremely, you know, sort of unnerving, especially because I'm absolutely terrified of alien abduction phenomena. That's one of the few things in all of this that really scares me.
It doesn't sound good, does it?
No, it really unnerves me. And his the fallout from it was so serious that, like I said, he actually burned all of his research, or a good number of his research that he had acquired, his archives and all that, and got completely out of paranormal research in general.
Seth, let's talk about Men in Black visitations in that area. You do pick up a couple of them.
Yeah, you do. What it seems like to me is these go all the way back to Kecksburg. And obviously these aren't your sort of John Keelian, you know, weirdly possible alien Men in Black, but you're more classic shady government officials covering up bizarre activity. Then, and like I said, it goes all the way back to Kecksburg, when you had these men in suits, dark suits, showing up on the Hayes farm, connected to the Kecksburg incident and leading to one of the larger UFO cover-ups in history. But it does stretch into the 1970s, and it directly intersects with sightings of Bigfoots in this one particular location known as the Superior Mobile Home Park, where there were frequent sightings in 1973 and 74 of creatures, hair-covered, you know, Bigfoot-like creatures in this mobile home park. There was one particular incident where they had found a Bigfoot track, near one of the mobile homes following a sighting of a creature. And the next day, this strange man shows up in a car with Ohio government plates. He claims he's with some sort of government agency, but what happened is he actually proceeded to stomp out the Bigfoot track, erase it, you know, basically from existence. And then there was a young boy there who had taken a photo of the track. And this man went over to the kid and actually snatched the photo away from him, said something like, "You just took that photo for us," put it in his pocket, and left in a hurry with this, you know, photo of this track. Now, what on earth the government would need a photo of a Bigfoot track for in 1973 or 74 is beyond, you know, anyone's guess, I guess, because it's such a strange report. But there were many other accounts of government type people, or people claiming to work for various branches of the government, showing up along the Chestnut Ridge and either erasing or outright stealing evidence relating to Bigfoot and UFO sightings. Jeez. And keep in mind, this is after Project Blue Book. So Project Blue Book, I don't even think would have been around by this point.
Cover-ups everywhere, huh?
Yeah.
Dogman. I know you mentioned it earlier, but describe what they look like.
So they're typically, the Dogman reports are of an upright walking, hair-covered canine-like creature, usually with very large teeth and sort of the classic Wolfman, you know, 1950s, 1940s Universal monster come to life. You know, what's strange about some of the reports along the ridge is they do involve these Dogman-type creatures with glowing eyes. So you have to wonder if there's a connection to the Bigfoot creatures, which also have these glowing eyes. But they, you know, it's kind of the classic Wolfman. I mean, if you can picture a giant wolf standing on its hind legs, that's literally what people are.
That's got to be with the tail and everything else.
Yeah, with the whole all the physical attributes you associate with a Dogman or a werewolf or a wolf. That's what these people are seeing.
And its front paws are like little arms, I guess.
Yeah, that can tear your throat out, apparently. And you know what's strange to me is some of the reports that we heard about, especially from Eric Altman, some of the reports he told us about of Dogman sightings, there was nothing particularly menacing about the creature. In fact, in two of the cases, it was almost as if it didn't even care that it was being seen. It's different from the Bigfoot reports you hear, where it's desperately trying to get out of sight of you know, whoever's seeing it. In the case of the Dogman report, it's almost as if they couldn't care less that you had noticed them, which goes back to some of the work Linda Godfrey has done with the Beast of Bray
right.
Road, where you hear similar accounts.
Just how many researchers are you think involved, Seth, in these kinds of stories in that region?
Dozens. I actually don't know of any other place in the United States that has as many active paranormal researchers, and really good ones too. Obviously, you've got Stan Gordon, but you've got Eric Altman and Sean Forker and Brian and Terry Seach and the Ruperts. There's all kinds of people based in Pennsylvania, and for the most part, those people will tell you that the activity that they most frequently look into is occurring along the Chestnut Ridge. That is the thing you hear the most out there. In fact, Stan Gordon told us that 70% or more of the cases he's taken since 1965, when he got into all this, since 1965, he's taken more, 70% of those reports come from the Chestnut Ridge area.
And I would guess that most of these reports are coming from people who are pretty darn serious about the reports, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. And in fact, if you take into account the fact that more than likely most sightings aren't reported, what's really astonishing is the sheer number of reports that are coming in. And then when you look at who's reporting them, they're just normal people. You know, they're local farmers or someone that's out hiking or you know, just blue-collar people.
They have no reason to lie, do they?
No, they don't.
No. Seth, we're going to come back and take phone calls with you, stories and questions next.